In recent years, it feels like we're hearing more and more about the Dutch Reformed theologian Herman Bavinck. Although most of his works were not translated into English until only very recently, his popularity has grown quickly among many pastors and theologians in the U.S. who have found him to be culturally insightful and pastorally wise. My guest today is Professor James Eglinton, and he has spent years studying Bavinck and working to share his insights with the English world. In our interview today, James introduces us to Bavinck's life and context, explains his role in the neo-Calvinistic movement in the Netherlands, and reflects on advice that Bavinck might offer evangelicals if he were alive today. James serves as the Meldrum Senior Lecturer in Reformed Theology at New College, the University of Edinburgh, and is the author of a major biography on Herman Bavinck. He's also the translator and editor of several books by Herman Bavinck, including Christianity and Science and Christian Worldview from Crossway. Let's get started. Well, James, thank you so much for joining me on the Crossway podcast.
Thanks, Matt. It's great to be here.
So in the last few years, it seems like I've been hearing the name of a long-dead theologian quite a lot, someone I didn't hear much about growing up when I was in high school and youth group, even in Bible college, maybe even in grad school a decade ago. I was not hearing his name bandied about like I am today. And I'm guessing that's probably true for many of our listeners, pastors, seminary students, regular lay people today who might be more theologically engaged. Nevertheless, they probably aren't very familiar with this guy, even if they have heard his name a lot in recent years. And before we get to him and you tell us about him, I want to just read a few quotes from some contemporary theologians today who we all would know, probably, who have said some things about him. So J.I. Packer called him a man of giant mind, vast learning, ageless wisdom, and great expository skill. John Frame, a famous systematic theologian today, said that his systematic theology, this other guy's, has been the fountainhead of Reformed theology for the last 100 years. Also writing about this systematic theology that he produced, Richard Gaffin said that it was arguably the most important ever produced in the Reformed tradition. It's a massive statement. And then finally, the late Tim Keller said, when it comes to theologians that contemporary church leaders should be reading, I don't know of a more important one than Herman Bavinck. So my first real question for you is, Herman Bavinck, does he really live up to the hype that we tend to be hearing today?
I think so. I hope so, because I've been reading him and investing my time in reading him and trying to help other people read him for quite a while now. I started reading him when I was in seminary back in Scotland, in Edinburgh, back in, I think, maybe 2005. That's when I first started to read him.
And his How are you introduced to him initially?
Well, so his most important work is called Reformed Dogmatics. It's a big four-volume set, and it was only translated, it was released in English between 2003 and 2008. So I was at seminary right in the middle of that time, and I had a systematic theology professor, Donald MacLeod, who had read some, he'd actually been reading Bavinck for quite a while before then in snippets that were translated.
Still in English?
In English, yeah. So there were little bits and pieces of Bavinck that had been available in English for a while. So he'd read those and was really impressed. And then when the Dogmatics came out, you know, for people who were in the know like that, they were aware from the little bits that they'd seen in English that this guy was really something special and his work was amazing. But, you know, unless you could read Dutch, then you didn't know. But you kind of lived in anticipation of when someone would finally translate the big work. So that happened. And then I was just at seminary around the time that it was coming out. And then Donald MacLeod would encourage us in class to read this guy, Herman Bavinck. And I wasn't disappointed. I thought this is just wonderful theology. And, you know, all of the quotes that you gave there, that was what I felt about reading him at the time as well. And, yeah, he does have this quite remarkable the name recognition across the English-speaking Christian world now. Even if, as you say, if still a lot of people might know the name, but they haven't necessarily read the works. The fact that the name recognition is out there is I think it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I think you've played a role in that. Even in you've written a biography of Bavinck. Mm. You've translated a couple of his works. We'll talk about some of that as we keep going. But maybe take us back a little bit. Help us understand for those of us who aren't very familiar with him, the man. Tell us a little bit about his life. When did he live? Where did he live? And what did he do?
Yeah, so he was from the Netherlands. He was born in 1854, and then he died in 1921. And if you think about those years, 1854 is a very different world to 1921. I mean, yeah. He lived through a period of incredible change. He was really born in a very different world to the one that he died in. And
I mean, born before the Civil War in America,
yeah.
And then died after World War I.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a period to live through.
Yeah.
And to live through all of that as... He was a fabulously gifted thinker, really erudite, very clear in how he could think and express himself. And to do all of that from a very resolutely Christian perspective and to chart all of that change and engage with so many things as he did, it just makes him quite remarkable. So, you know, we think of him, if we think of him at all in the English-speaking world, as a theologian, and we have that as quite a clear-cut category for him. And
that's,
you know,
a valid category.
It's a valid category, absolutely. He certainly was a theologian, a theologian and a half. But in his own lifetime, what I think makes him really remarkable, and what I tried to draw out in the biography, is that alongside his theological work, he wrote about so many other topics. He wrote books on psychology, he was an educational reformer and also an educational theorist. He wrote a couple of biographies. He led a political party, not very successfully, but he did it, and that's yeah. still quite a thing. He was a member of parliament for a decade, a really effective Christian in politics. He wrote poetry, again, not that well, but we should acknowledge that he did that.
Took a shot at it.
Yeah, he tried. And he was a journalist. He became a national newspaper editor. I mean, it's the stuff that a, you know, biographer's dreams are made of,
yeah.
because his life was so complex and textured. So in his own lifetime, his own contemporaries quite often struggle to find a label to put on Bavinck. And there'd be all kinds of debates about, you know, is he a philosopher? Is he, because he wrote a lot of philosophy as well. Is he a historian? Is he a theologian? Is he a pedagogue? Is he a psychologist? And then towards the end of his life, people started to settle actually on the label polymath in mm-hmm. his own lifetime to try and describe him.
Define that word.
So a polymath. So if you think back to like Leonardo da Vinci, you know, the idea of the Renaissance man. You know, if you think of, well, what was Leonardo? He was a painter. He was
an engineer.
An engineer. He was a war theorist. Mm. He was an anatomist. You know, so someone who pursues knowledge of a bunch of different things to a very high level. So that idea of the Renaissance man, or someone who masters different disciplines. I mean, to work in different disciplines is a kind of literal meaning of polymath. So Bavinck was someone who was like that, and that's a little. We've kind of lost touch with what that looks like in the 21st century, because if you think of when Bavinck was around, you know, he had to read a lot to master all these different disciplines. But the 20th century was this age of hyper specialization of knowledge and expertise and all of these things. So it's quite difficult nowadays to be, you know, a leading scholar of psychology and theology, just even within theology, just to try and keep on top of things in one niche area.
The advancements in each of these disciplines has gotten so deep.
Are so deep. So, you know, we live in an age of you know, like hyper specialized experts in all fields of life. But there's something that's lost a little bit with not really having a lot of polymaths like Bavinck around anymore, in that the life of a polymath shows you one individual who can see a lot of dots and who tries to connect them in a very thoughtful way. And they're just fascinating figures in that regard. And in Bavinck's case, he's a Christian who's connecting all the dots and trying to embody this all in one life as well. So there's a kind of holism. It's a really holistic example of how to live as a Christian. And, you know, for us, we live in a very fragmented age. And I think this is what I find so tremendously appealing and edifying with Bavinck and reading him over the years, is the Christian faith it's a really holistic faith. It's a faith for all of life, and it shouldn't be something that's just siloed off in one part of your life that's, you know, a faith compartment, and it doesn't have anything to say to the rest of life. For Bavinck, the whole of life should be an expression of your Christian faith, and that's what he tried to do. So, and that's just such a valuable kind of example.
Yeah, and that gets into the topic of Neo-Calvinism. I want to get into that in just a moment, but a little bit more on Bavinck the man. You've told us about his professional life, his achievements, his even his theological vision. Tell us a little bit more about what he was like as a man. Was he married? Did he have children? What did his friends say about him in terms of his personality?
Yeah, he did marry. So part of what I uncovered when I was writing my biography was that there's a tragic love story there that nobody had really looked at before, because it's all written in his teenage diaries, and his diaries when he's in his 20s and early 30s, but it's all written in Latin as a kind of code language to keep the secret. But yeah, there's a really sad love story there with the woman that he hoped to marry, and then he was rejected multiple times by her father. So that didn't happen. And then he was a kind of sad and lonely singleton in his 20s, and that's why he spent his 20s reading all the time, and that's why he could produce all of this work. But he did marry in the end a pretty remarkable woman, Johanna, who was a really formidable character in her own right, a really industrious, intelligent woman, a passionate Anglophile, really cosmopolitan kind of person, and a very thoughtful Christian as well, who picked up on a lot of his work after he died and co-founded a journal after he died called Christianity and the Women's Movement, which was thinking through the place of women in society in the 20th century from a Christian perspective.
He was a big advocate for women's suffrage.
Yeah, he was. He married and they had one daughter. He himself was he's a reserved person.
You see pictures of him, and he's a little intimidating looking. He doesn't look like the most gregarious guy in the world.
Yeah, he doesn't in pictures, but then nobody really did in the 19th
that's
century.
That's they just didn't the smile much back then.
They didn't. You know, if you have to sit for like 8 minutes to have your picture taken, you'd have to sleep with a coat hanger in your mouth the night before just to hold that smile. So people looked kind of serious then. So, he was someone who I think probably projected his thoughts a lot, but maybe less so his feelings. So that kind of personal side. He had a small number of friends who he corresponded with, and they were really his close companions. Mm. But they were also spread out internationally. So like Gerhardus Voss, maybe some listeners might know him, the really important biblical theology guy in the old Princeton tradition. He had a friend who was his polar opposite in every way, and actually converted to Islam as well. And that was a really important long-term friendship.
A Dutch friend?
A Dutch friend,
wow.
Yeah. And he had a couple of friends who died at various points in his life as well. And then, close companions that he built up friendships with over many years then are ended and separated by death. So he really had valued close relationships, but I don't think he was a social butterfly or something like that. So not an outrageous extrovert,
yeah,
but a really sincere, warm person. So when you find him, or when you find accounts of him from his students, they loved him. And he really gave himself to his students, and didn't kind of hold back from investing in them. So those kinds of accounts you see are of a very warm Christian.
Yeah.
But he was just a very careful thinker in every regard. He wasn't a swashbuckling, his colleague Abraham Kuyper was this larger than life character, and Bavinck wasn't like that at all.
Yeah. Did he have any children?
He did, yeah. They had one daughter, and her family story is also pretty remarkable. And his daughter married a lawyer, and they had three sons. And in World War II, they were part of the underground resistance movement against the Nazis because they lived under Nazi occupation. And this Bavinck's son-in-law, as a lawyer, would try and protect Jewish possessions from being taken over by the Nazis, and they would hide Jews in their house, that kind of stuff. And eventually the sons worked for an underground resistance newspaper, and they were just teenagers doing this kind of stuff. So they were raided by Nazis, and Bavinck's son-in-law eventually died in a concentration camp. Two of Bavinck's grandsons for the role in the resistance were executed by Nazis. One of his grandsons survived, hidden in the loft of their house, and his daughter survived. But they were a really remarkable family in that regard as well. So, and their story had never really been told before the biography. So there's a kind of postscript telling the story of the Bavinck family after Hermann.
Yeah, it's amazing. It kind of connects into even some of his comments about race and racism. Mm. He came to America and was very critical of the racism that he found here in the years post the Civil War, early 1900s. Yeah. That's maybe another conversation. Mm. So tell us about neo-Calvinism. That's this term that's often associated with the likes of Bavinck and Kuyper.
Yeah.
What was that movement, and what was his role?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was a movement that sprung up in the late 19th century in the Netherlands, and it was originally a pejorative term, as a lot of these great terms that stick.
So Calvinism would have been the established framework, and so the neo part was like a...
So you could think of it like this. So they were Christians in the Reformed tradition, and they wanted to address the big questions of their day from within that tradition. So if you think of, in their way of talking about this anyway, Calvinism for them meant like what John Calvin was doing in the 16th century. And they were in that tradition, but they were aware that they lived in a very different period. So a lot of the questions that they faced just weren't questions that existed in Calvin's time. So you can't just carry on doing Calvinism only with what you find in John Calvin.
What would be an example of some issues that they were facing?
So the Industrial Revolution. Okay, so all of a sudden you have these huge factories, and one person owns the whole thing, but there might be thousands of workers in there, and you know the factory conditions weren't great in Western Europe in that period, and so you have lots of questions around, well, how do we think through work, for example, or the economy? For Bavinck, these people are the image of God, and they spend their lives on factory lines, and they die young because their bodies are just worn out. What should Christians think of that? I mean, that just didn't exist in Calvin's time. Or, you know, we think of a really big issue that's very different in Calvin's time to the late 19th century in the West. In Calvin's Geneva, there was a guy called Miguel Servetus, who was an anti-Trinitarian heretic and who was burned at the stake because he was anti-Trinitarian.
Something Calvin himself even approved of.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess in Calvin's own take on this, I mean, everyone approved of it.
Yeah.
Protestants and Catholics. This is a capital offense to be explicitly anti-Trinitarian. And for Bavinck and Kuyper, you know, they live in a very different world, yeah. Centuries
much
on.
Much more pluralistic world.
Yeah, pluralistic worlds where they don't think that people should be executed for being anti-Trinitarians. So the questions that they face are just different, and that means that there are parts of this older Calvinism that they actually want to challenge and revise for what they thought were Christian reasons, actually. That's the neo part, that they want to continue to develop Calvinism. So there were people in the background there who also would call themselves Reformed and thought they were drawing on Calvin, but they were really radically revising Calvinism. So they saw this as a living tradition they wanted to continue. And that meant in some ways you have to go back and challenge what you find before. Mm. But you also have to expand the tradition because the questions are new. So, you know, there are all kinds of advances in the natural sciences. You know, they're facing questions about evolutionary theory. You know, Darwin is there in the background. There are all kinds of questions about new technologies, the structure of society, the family in society, democracy. I mean, that didn't really exist in Calvin's Geneva. Mass democracy is this big new thing that they're having to ask all these questions about. So the neo part is really a way of understanding this older tradition that continues to move forward, and they're trying to push it forward.
How would you draw a distinction between a neo-Calvinistic view of the world that's seeking to engage culture, transform culture? There's a lot of these ideas of living as Christians in the world that precede the rise of neo-Calvinism. So what was the new insight or impulse that they were bringing to this idea of engaging as Christians with the rest of the world?
So Christians who've done this in the past have done so in the context of Christendom, at least in the West. So you're trying to show that Christianity is this basis for, it expresses itself in every area of life and you know, enriches all of these areas. But in Christendom, that was done against the backdrop where, you know, fundamentally the way people think about society supports that. Mm. But
and even that Christendom was supported by the power of the state.
Yeah.
Ultimately, the state is enforcing this vision of the Christian life.
But after the Enlightenment, so we're talking now late modern Western Europe, Christendom is really, I mean, for Kuyper, he already identified in the early 20th century, this is now post-Christendom. So now there's not that supportive infrastructure, and now there's actually this kind of challenge across the board that, well, maybe Christianity should be, you know, removed from every area of life, and that kind of vision of secularization that says, you know, religion is a part of our past but not our present or our future. So without any support from that back, you know, supportive backdrop, and actually with the challenge to eject Christianity from everything, you have a push in the opposite direction to say that maybe Christianity hinders us from flourishing in all of life, and we're certainly not going to support it. So from that very different backdrop, all of a sudden, Christianity is challenged to give a really positive, holistic account of itself, not just in the church and in soteriology, but in all of life. And neo-Calvinism is this, in history, it's this attempt to do that in the secularizing late modern Western context, and done with tremendous confidence in the Christian faith that it's going to pass the test.
Yeah.
And actually, so Kuyper's argument is that in those settings, the outcome is even more glorious. You know, so for Christianity to succeed in expressing itself holistically in all of life in the context of Christendom, that's amazing that Christianity can do that. But to do so when it faces opposition is even better for Kuyper. So he thought that Christianity looked even more glorious in a post-Enlightenment context when it succeeds in the face of discouragement rather than encouragement. So it's not novel in that sense in their eyes, in terms of it didn't just spring out of nowhere. It's like it's an ongoing continuation of what Christians have been trying to do, but they're just very aware of their context.
Yeah, the changing, the way the world is changing, yeah. The rise of secularization, as you said. Yeah. So would you say when it comes to neo-Calvinism as espoused by people like Kuyper and Bavinck, it's fair to summarize their posture towards the prevailing secular culture broadly as one of engagement and transformation even, rather than resistance and maybe retreat?
I think you can see both. So if we're thinking of, you know, Kuyper's life or Bavinck's life, you know, we're talking about like the 1870s, 80s, and 90s. And then that's one particular period where all of this is developing. So that those decades in Dutch culture were really ripe for institution building. And there were lots of different streams in society that all had different visions of the future of Christianity in Dutch culture. And for some people in some of those streams, it was secularization means progress beyond religion. And now we have a secular state that meets all of our needs. And they didn't believe in like miracles or the resurrection or anything anyway, so Christianity is just part of our past and we don't need it anymore. And there were other streams who were trying to articulate different visions of Christianity is important to our future and our present.
A certain version of Christianity.
Yeah. So the neo-Calvinists emerged as one, you know, one group advancing particular claims. And probably the most kind of holistic way to articulate Christianity in that context. And, you know, they had this view that I mentioned before that orthodoxy is always moving forward and expanding and addressing new questions whenever, wherever it meets them. So they were really confident that Christianity could go on to do this. And
because I think the liberal tradition, the liberal trajectories of Christianity, they kind of almost had a continually shrinking Christianity, right? As technological scientific advances are happening, they're slowly eating away at mm-hmm. what it means to be Christian.
Yeah.
Whereas you're saying these neo-Calvinists were kind of saying, no, the core of Christian orthodoxy is solid,
yeah.
and it's going to continue to expand even as we understand the world more.
Yeah, it's always big enough to answer any new questions. And, you know, they thought that history wasn't static either. So they thought, you know, humans are curious and creative, and they'll always create new questions, but Christianity will always meet that challenge. So in those decades, Dutch culture is very much, you know, busy with its own like reinvention all the time, and the neo-Calvinists are a voice within that who are saying actually we really need Christianity far more than a lot of people say we do. And they were really successful with this, you know, they created lots of institutions, newspapers, they founded a university, they were really enterprising within society, and the trajectory looked really good for them. And then Kuyper ended up becoming prime minister as well, so they had a Christian political party.
Kind of that they reached the highest echelons of power.
They did, and they were also very committed to democracy within all of this, and they were arguing for a vision of society where Christians should be free to be Christians, but also they give that same freedom to others. So they have, you know,
wasn't a kind of Christian nationalism they were advocating for.
No, it would be really anachronistic to take also, you know, American versions of that today and project it back. But no, it wasn't. It was very much a vision of like Christian democracy, kind of Christianity is the foundation of democracy, but then that means that Christians give freedom to non-Christians to have a place within society. So then Kuyper is prime minister all of a sudden, and it looks like the zenith, you know, of what they were trying to achieve. But that was at the very beginning of the 20th century, but he only lasted one term. And then after that, Dutch culture really changed. So
would you say it's fair to say that this neo-Calvinistic impulse, at least in the Netherlands, that it, while it had a bright beginning and, you know, seemed to achieve a lot of noble ends, it didn't really last? It didn't really actually work?
So that's a critique that I hear a lot, but I always push back against it and argue that it did work and has been really successful even to the present day. So Kuyper lasted one term as prime minister, and then, you know, he died in 1920, Bavinck died in 1921, and you've got World War One in the middle of that, and they're pretty bleak years in Western Europe. And also
Friedrich, the Great Depression.
The Great Depression
sweeps around the whole world.
Yeah, so there was Friedrich Nietzsche, you know, this great atheist who died in 1900, and the Dutch didn't really care about him in his lifetime, but he became really popular very quickly in Dutch culture. So atheism, and a very new kind of atheism, becomes quite fashionable. And so in those two decades, what you see in Bavinck and Kuyper is that they both realize something has changed in Western culture, and it's really becoming, it's post-Christendom now. It's not entirely post-Christian in their view. We still swim in very Christian waters, but people are trying to just explore all kinds of things to move on from eventually from Christendom in a very comprehensive sense. So then you find Bavinck talking a lot about evangelism, way more than he had earlier in his life, and also within the Netherlands. And you find Kuyper really starting to develop as a kind of missional thinker in his own context. I mean, the late Kuyper is fascinating. He's not in any way triumphalist about Dutch culture or anything like that. He's really trying to think through what has happened here.
So he kind of sees the future of, like, Christians are not going to be the center of society like they once were.
He didn't think they were the center even after his time in
even as prime minister, he wouldn't have said that.
Well, certainly after his term as prime minister. Yeah. And he's really very realistic about the challenges of his own day. So in that regard, like, it didn't stay like a neo-Calvinist governed country for very long. But I think that they succeeded in some really profound ways in relation to what they actually tried to do. I don't think that they tried to set up, you know, neo-Calvinist-led country forever. I mean, the government that Kuyper led was also a minority government, and so he was democratically elected, but, you know, it wasn't like 99% of the people all wanted Abraham Kuyper.
They were always limited in what they could
do. But the things that they achieved that have been successful unto the present day are things like, so they campaigned really hard for the government to fund Christian schools and Christian universities. And their argument there was basically that the government funds what it regards as neutral schools, don't teach on the basis of a worldview, but it won't fund people whose teaching and education is explicitly run on the basis of a worldview.
And so this echoes a lot of the conversation happening in America today, actually.
Yeah, no doubt. So Bavinck and Kuyper argued over decades that everyone has presuppositions, everyone has a philosophy, and the government is arbitrary and biased in only supporting these apparently neutral schools and in not supporting schools that are just honest about what they believe, but everyone has beliefs. So eventually they won in 1917, and the government agreed, okay, we recognize that all schools have a worldview, and we fund equally, and we'll also fund universities as well. And you still have that to the present day. So, you know, I lived in the Netherlands for 3 years. In Scotland, the government funds Roman Catholic schools, and it funds apparently neutral schools that are just taught not on the basis of any particular philosophy. Philosophically, I think
it's incoherent.
Yeah, it doesn't work at all. And obviously, the apparently neutral schools teach on the basis of a philosophy because we're human beings. Nobody lives without a whole bunch of presuppositions and a priori. Yeah. So they were talking about that kind of context as well. But even today in the Netherlands, when I lived in the Netherlands, you know, my kids went to a state-funded Christian school that's run by the church, but it's supported by the state because Christians pay their taxes. So why shouldn't those taxes go towards the kind of schools that actually allow Christians to raise their kids holistically? I worked for a Christian university that was state funded. That doesn't exist in the UK.
Yeah.
That still exists in the Netherlands today. And it's a really big deal. 10% of the Dutch population or so is a practicing Orthodox Protestant. So I think that a century on, what Kuyper and Bavinck achieved has a huge legacy that's really important. In the Netherlands, every day I had a choice of different really high-quality Christian national newspapers where, you know, I would read the same news as any other newspaper reported, but it's actually being put together from a Christian perspective. We don't have that in the UK. You know, in the Netherlands, you can choose between multiple Christian political parties where you actually feel like you're represented as a Christian and they take part in democracy. And again, we don't have that in the UK. So a lot of people in America and in the UK look on the Netherlands and, you know, there's a pretty shallow stereotype that it's just all, you know, the kind of drugs and prostitution.
We look at places like Amsterdam, we kind of hear some of the horror stories about the secularization and
But that's one part of Dutch society, but there's so much of it that people outside of the Netherlands aren't aware of. And none of that would exist without Bavinck or Kuyper.
Yeah.
So I think at one level, I mean, the Netherlands is quite remarkable in Western Europe, in secular Western Europe, that the government actually supports that kind of stuff still.
Yeah, that's amazing. So let's talk a little bit then about Bavinck's works. You've already mentioned a few of them, and you've already mentioned that for a long time, up until just fairly recently, most of his works were not available in English, which probably explains why so many of us have this feeling of, whoa, who's this new guy on the block that people are talking about now? Let's start with that magnum opus that you mentioned, his Reformed Dogmatics. That's this multi-volume systematic theology. What is it about that work that is so impressive?
Reformed Dogmatics is a four-volume work. So it's really impressive in that it's very long. but a book can be long and unimpressive because it's long-winded or repetitive, and it's not like that at all. So volume one is the Prolegomena, and it's quite dense and tough to read. It's really high level, but And a lot of systematic theologians who were writing at the same time didn't include a volume like that. They just got straight into, you know, the doctrine of God or creation.
Yeah.
But the Prolegomena is Bavinck facing up to all of the questions that you need to ask in order to do theology. Can we know God? What is the basis of our knowledge of God? Because, you know, a huge part of the Enlightenment was Immanuel Kant saying there is no knowledge of God.
So epistemic questions.
Yeah, so the epistemic questions that you really need to ask in order to do theology. Hmm. So then after that, volumes 2, 3, and 4, I've argued in the past, are actually structured around the Apostles' Creed. You know, so the Apostles' Creed is structured around the three persons of the Godhead, and then around creation by the Father, and then salvation in Christ, and then the Church, and recreation through the Holy Spirit. So volume 2 of Bavinck's Dogmatics is about God, the doctrine of God, and the doctrine of creation. Volume 3 is Christology, sin, Christology, salvation. Volume 4, the Holy Spirit, the Church, new creation. So what I've tried to argue, actually, in writing about Bavinck in the past, is that the Reformed Dogmatics is an enormous exposition of the Apostles' Creed. Mm. And in that regard, it's not sectarian theology. I mean, what Bavinck is trying to argue is that his Reformed tradition is the best, most comprehensive way to explore and elaborate on and expand the Apostles' Creed. Mm. So he's trying to show that it's really Catholic, small c, lowercase c, in spirit, and also very Reformed in what that looks like, actually. So the idea is that wherever you are in the Reformed Dogmatics, you can always trace it back ultimately to the Creed. So in that regard, it's a really impressive work.
So another book that you actually were involved with translating and editing is Christian Worldview.
Yep.
Tell us about what Bavinck is doing in that small book.
Yep. So in that book, the background to it is that in the Netherlands in that period, you have the Neo-Calvinists who are very transparent thinkers in saying our starting point in how we think is Christian, and we have a whole load of Christian assumptions. Ultimately, you know, the first presupposition is that God is there, that God exists. And on that basis, we move forward in how we think about the world and how we're going to live within it. So we are just explicitly Christian. And we, you know, the Christian is this adjective that shapes everything, actually. But there's this rival claim in society that is people who say, well, we're really neutral and we've managed to free ourselves from the straitjacket of bias and presupposition and we just do science.
We never hear that today.
Yeah, nothing much has changed. I mean, the English-speaking world is just catching up with the Netherlands. So you have all these people who will claim that I don't have a worldview. I just
looking at the facts.
I'm just looking at the facts, yeah. And like, I'm not interpreting anything, and I don't have any, you know, a priori starting points. You know, I'm cool-headed, detached, unbiased, and the way that I see things is the way that things are. And so, but what Bavinck is trying to argue is that in that book, well, actually, everyone has to live on the basis of starting assumptions. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't put those assumptions to the test. That's really important too.
And they might not be right
about them. Yeah, indeed. Yeah, they might be wrong, or they might be right. But we all live on the basis of starting points that we take for granted. So we should all be honest enough to admit that we're all trying to pursue a particular worldview. So Bavinck tries to help Christians think that through by looking at the kind of questions that you need to ask in order to build a worldview. And they're questions about what am I? And can I know things? If I can, what can I know? And then if it's possible for me to know things, how then should I live on the basis of what I am and what I know? Mm. So Bavinck's argument is that we all live by assumption that we have answers to those questions. And we might not even realize that there are questions there. We just take the answers as though they're just obvious to all people, and the way that you are is the way that all people should be. And that's really the kind of argument that he faced from this kind of secular side that regarded itself as neutral. You know, the Christian should stop being Christian because we're not Christians, so therefore you shouldn't be either. So the book Christian Worldview is his attempt to set up a kind of set of what are ultimately quite philosophical questions, but you have to ask them because humans are like philosophical creatures, really. Mm. We all, you know, need to ask those kinds of questions. So the book Christian Worldview sets out those questions and tries to, it lays down a bit of a gauntlet for people who might say, I don't even have a worldview. I'm not affected by worldview. You know, this is just the way things are.
I would imagine for some of our listeners, this might make them think of presuppositional apologetics and, you know, Cornelius Van Til and the work that he did and others and following after him. How connected would what Bavinck was saying on this stuff, what we would consider today to be Christian presuppositionalism?
I mean, it's all it's all related. So the Neo-Calvinist tradition is just quite strong on this, and the insistence that people do have presuppositions. All people do. It's just that it's not possible to live a human life without presupposing a whole load of things every day. Bavinck's way of talking about this is that human life cannot be lived on a purely a posteriori basis, as though it's only when you start off on it from a neutral perspective and then put everything to the test. And yes, nobody is a blank slate where all of the big decisions are reached and relied on a posteriori. Instead, everyone lives out an a posteriori kind of existence. So yeah, you can find that kind of presuppositional approach elsewhere. I think maybe something that the neo-Calvinists, particularly Bavinck and Kuyper, don't do is, I don't think they elevate it to an ism. Later in his life, Bavinck starts to see humans as incredibly inconsistent creatures, in that people might have particular presuppositions, but that doesn't always determine what they do, how they live out those presuppositions. People are just—that's actually part of the chaos that sin brings in. Sin is a kind of lawlessness. We're even lawless in relation to the assumptions that we make.
Yeah,
it should determine how we live.
And sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't.
Yeah, indeed. And also, common grace is a factor for how they think about presuppositions and how we live them out. In that, you know, for us in sin and in Adam, actually, you know, our unregenerate hearts have really bad presuppositions. The a priori's are towards evil rather than towards our creator. And if we were left to be really consistent with unregenerate presuppositions, this world would be a truly awful place. But in the doctrine of common grace, which they see as rooted again in Calvin, God has a restraining hand on our capacity for evil, and we're not the worst version of ourselves, thankfully. And that means that sometimes, you know, we might have presuppositions that should lead to far worse outcomes, but God doesn't let that happen. And those things are quite hard to predict, you know, the inconsistency of humans, and also the mysterious workings in God's providence of his common grace and that restraining hand. So they're, Bavinck and Kuyper, are very aware of the reality and the power of presuppositions, but I think those other factors maybe stop it from becoming some kind of a predictive ism. All I have to do is show you I think maybe Bavinck's actually a bit stronger on this than Kuyper, but certainly for Bavinck, you know, it's not the case that if you just tell me your presuppositions, then boom, I already know you and I can say exactly what you're going to do in this situation.
So maybe one last book to talk about that you, again, have been very involved with translating and editing is Christianity and Science. And immediately our minds in the American context are probably going to go to all these debates around science and how we integrate it with faith and arguments around evolution and the age of the earth. But that's not exactly what Bavinck was focusing on in this book. Tell us a little bit about what he was doing.
Yeah, indeed. So the title is maybe provocative in that regard, and I hope it draws in an audience and surprises some people. But that kind of debate is a very Anglophone debate. I think some readers in the UK might have a similar kind of impression that by science, you therefore mean the natural sciences. And you know, for a lot of the 20th century, those debates have been focused on seeing the natural sciences and Christianity as things that are hard to integrate. So they come from very separate places. But in Bavinck's context, the Dutch word wetenschap, which we translate as science, has quite a different meaning. So wetenschap, or science in this Dutch context, refers to things that you come to know by effort and by investigation. So it's not just stuff that you know effortlessly or intuitively. It's actually stuff that you have to go and work hard to find
study.
Out. Yeah, you have to study, exactly. And that is true of a physicist. It's true of a geologist. It's true of a linguist. It's true of a theologian. It's true of a philosopher. It's true of a scholar of literature. It's all knowledge that you have to go and work hard to find out. And you have to work hard to find out that knowledge on the basis of appropriate methods, and the methods then, you know, enable you to have some kind of expertise so that you can speak with authority on your field. And there's one word for all of this, wetenschap, or science. So what you have in that kind of history is you don't have a bias towards some disciplines over others because they get to use one very powerful word. And that's what we have in the English-speaking world.
Follow the science.
Or, you know, how often you hear people end a conversation with, you know, because science.
It's meant to be that hammer that kind of shuts down any objections.
Indeed. I've yet to hear someone, you know, shut down an objection with, you know, because the humanities, you know, duh. That just doesn't really happen. And so Herman Bavinck was
only ironically might that be laid down.
Okay. I'm going to do it, but try and do it subversively then.
Okay.
So Herman Bavinck was really critical of the way that this works in the English speaking world, because it was still like that in his day. So this is not a new thing. So that we restrict the word science to things that you know on the basis of the empirical method and that you know by sense perception, and that's authoritative knowledge. So, you know, a scientist is someone who really knows with a lot of authority, but humanities scholars just deal in very subjective opinions, but they're not real experts. And as a kind of popular culture impression. But for Bavinck, these are all Wetenschappen, they're all sciences, and they're all forms of knowledge that you have to acquire. So the playing field is much more level and much more even. So this book, Christianity and Science, the original title is just Christian Science in Dutch, but we can't really render it like that in English.
Different connotations here.
The connotations are different, and it doesn't really work in the English-speaking world. But we titled it Christianity and Science in English, rather than Christianity and Scholarship, because we thought that if we call it Christianity and Scholarship, that's still biasing things towards the natural sciences. And we thought, no, you know, Bavinck would hate that title if we called it Christianity and Scholarship, because it's precisely the thing he critiques.
It's giving up this word science.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's giving it over to something that he really wanted to challenge. So what he's trying to do in this book is make a case for Christianity as a thing that expresses itself in the life of the mind, and in how we try and pursue knowledge and obtain it, and knowledge of lots of different things. In fact, the whole sphere of our existence and the creation. So that will include the natural sciences and things that appropriately are known by sense perception and the empirical method, but it also includes the humanities. There are also things that they're fields of inquiry where we have to obtain knowledge, and you have to have particular methods that are appropriate, and therefore you have particular people with distinct forms of expertise there. So you can't get like a physicist and say, tell us how to interpret this section of Othello and do it with authority because you've got the empirical method. That just doesn't work. That's not livable. And if you have this very weighted, skewed approach to the natural science people are the true scientists, the true experts, and the rest of us just vague opinions people, that's quite a shrunken form of human existence.
Well, it's pretty amazing too to think that one of the main critiques from Christians in recent decades, especially of the new atheists, so to speak, has been that they often do overstep. They step out of their sphere of expertise, the natural sciences of, say, astrophysicists or the biology, and they start to make all these philosophical pronouncements that they don't even necessarily know that they're making. Yeah. But they are kind of going beyond, or they're making ethical claims, moral claims based on, you know, this biological discipline.
Yeah.
Bavinck would presumably kind of have words to say to that.
So we have some celebrity atheists, they're based in the academy, but, you know, celebrity atheists, intellectuals who will say, they'll make what are in effect philosophical pronouncements, but they'll say, this is just because of science, and I don't do philosophy at all, I just do science.
Or philosophy is just a bunch of people, you know, they'll demean philosophy as this kind of unimportant subjective exercise.
Yeah. So we have one celebrity academic in the UK, high-profile humanist, who, on Easter Sunday will make a point of tweeting, this is your annual reminder that dead people don't rise from the grave. And, you'll have Christians who will push back against this and say, well, let's talk about, the assumptions that you make about metaphysics and why Christians think it's reasonable to say that actually the resurrection did happen. And the moment that you introduce some philosophy to the conversation, you'll get some kind of reply that says, oh, I don't deny the resurrection because of philosophy. I just do science. There's no philosophy involved. And so Bavinck would push back against that to say, of course there's philosophy involved. You're a human being, and all scientific inquiry presupposes a particular metaphysic, it presupposes a particular approach to philosophy. And what Bavinck is trying to do in this book, Christianity and Science, is just be really transparent and saying, my inquiry also presupposes a philosophy, so does yours. And this is how my Christian faith gives a very coherent way of grounding all these things together. So tell me, what's your starting point? Because it's not neutrality. And show me that it can do a better job than Christianity.
All right, maybe a last few final fun and somewhat speculative questions about Herman Bavinck. I thought it'd be fun to hear you answer. So what advice would Bavinck offer us today related to the increasing polarization that we see in the U.S., but probably around the world as well, in the West? Political polarization, ecclesiological polarization. We just see this fracturing all around us, it seems. What would Bavinck say to that?
I think in the first place, he would offer a historical reminder, maybe specifically within the US, of what that was like for him, because he came to America twice. And one of the really interesting observations he left behind was that Dutch culture to him was very polarized, but American culture wasn't. And he made this fascinating comment that in America, people think that you can be a Christian and be a Republican, and you can be a Christian and be a Democrat. And he said, and neither denies the other a place in heaven, which is quite a way to put it. And so he thought that
America might be less true today, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe less true today, but he was struck by how civil Americans were in their disagreements and how non-polarized they were, despite their two-party system.
And despite the legacy of the Civil War, which happened... Yeah. After he was born.
And it might be like a rosy picture that wasn't totally accurate, but that's what he was struck by anyway, enough to write it down and tell Dutch people, we should be more like the Americans because they treat each other much better than we do. So he would offer some kind of reminder maybe of that. But I think something that's a reminder that he might offer as well. So if you think of the history of Christendom, that offers you, in terms of the cultural waters that you swim in, a basic set of ways of thinking about human beings and the dynamics of our relationships that factor in sin, grace, forgiveness. And all of those really make a big difference in how you'll get on with people who differ from you. The kind of Christian cultural waters that Western people had been used to swimming in for so long, that gave them quite deep intuitions about themselves as as imperfect, as sinners who receive grace, who receive a lot of immense patience from God, and who then have deep intuitions about that towards other people. That as we move away from Christendom, there are elements of a return to maybe what was there before all of those Christian intuitions came into the world.
A paganism, you might
call it. Of paganism. Yeah, some kind of return to that, and we inherit a lot of those intuitions in the West from Augustine. And Augustine was someone who, before he was a Christian, had been a Manichaean. And Manichaeanism is this, everything is like light or dark, and everything is divided between good and evil. And you better make sure you know which side you're on, and you don't want to be contaminated by the other side. And it's not a way of thinking about life or the world that has those categories of grace and forgiveness.
Yeah.
And accepting, you know what, within my own life, there's a whole lot of right and wrong.
And this original sin and indwelling sin are not, it's more of you're pure or you're defiled.
Yeah, exactly. So you think in those very stark categories. That's a direction that Western culture might go in, where instead of being very Augustinian, which is what we'd been for a very long time, we would actually, by rejecting him, then we revert to what he had before that, which is this, you're either pure or defiled. You're either in my camp or the other camp, and I will not hold hands with you in any sense.
Wow.
Because I don't want to be contaminated by you. And I think that's, we see lots of that in Western culture. We just don't have those categories anymore of grace and forgiveness and our own imperfection. And therefore, we just don't want to be defiled by people who aren't in our camp. And we really have to make sure that everyone knows that we do a lot of throat clearing about our own purity and the impurity of others and the distance we keep from them. So I think that they would probably, I think the Bavinks would give us some really great resources in thinking those things through.
And you're saying they foresaw that to some extent. All right, another question. How would Bavinck counsel Christians to think about new digital technologies, and including the rise of AI, the kind of big thing that we're all thinking about right now?
Yeah, I guess, continuing a lot of what I've said already in this conversation, Christian orthodoxy rises to meet every challenge. And so he would be really positive about Christians being in those conversations in the first place. I mean, I think Bavinck has a really good way of thinking about technology or technologies within the context of the doctrine of creation. And, if you talk to scholars of AI, who'll talk about the problems of AI, really what they will draw you to is that the problems of AI are really the issues of the humans that create it. I know there's the kind of science fiction AI where we're all worried about Terminator 2 scenario or something, and the robotic uprising. When you talk to real scholars of AI, I mean, the science fiction AI isn't really what they're talking about. So the real challenges are challenges for the humans, and that will come down to things like the dignity of work, the place of changing labor patterns in society.
All things that Bavinck, in his own way, was responding to with the rise of industrialization.
Yeah,
in his own day.
Indeed. But I think with Herman Bavinck, you can actually see something that he does with the invention of the washing machine and the dishwasher that shows a real intelligence and an attentiveness to thinking about technology. Because, so for Bavinck, he could, the washing machine and the dishwasher were brand new, cutting edge inventions at the end of his life. And before then, to run a household meant in the Netherlands, that if you have a bunch of kids, well, their clothes have to be washed by hand, all the dishes have to be washed by hand.
All the cups that I see every day.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. I mean, in my family, we once had that 2-week period when our dishwasher broke down, and we have 4 kids, and until the new one could be delivered, and our evenings were just all spent washing dishes. And it takes up so much time. And you realize that if you didn't have this technology, life would be very different.
Yeah.
So Bavinck could foresee that if these technologies, he said, if they become affordable, then the world will change. And then we really have to think all kinds of big questions about the way that the technology actually then forces a reactive change in how humans live their lives. So there's a shift from what people who write about technology would think of as a tool-based view of technology, that these are just things that we use, to a view of technology where you actually have to start thinking in quite profound ways about how the technology means that we react to it. So an AI will do that. So you can see early forms of ways of thinking about that as a Christian in Bavinck that open that conversation up. So he covers some of that ground too.
Mm. What about the dominance of expressive individualism that we see around us today? Maybe seen most vividly in the sexual revolution that we're seeing around us when it comes to things like orientation and gender, where there's just this radical individualism and self-determination. What would Bavinck say about that?
Yeah. Bavinck wrote a lot about individuality over his lifetime. He thought that individuality is a God-given gift. He thought it was a really good thing that, no two humans are exactly alike. But the consistent challenge that he poses to people in his own day is that when you elevate individuality into an ism, then you really crush individuality. So individuality needs a bigger thing to be part of for it actually to be well sustained. So the context that he's pushing back against is the kind of individuality that was asserted, he thought, in the French Revolution and in the kind of philosophy that went with that. So he thought that that individuality had been really crushed by a kind of individualism that tells people, or that told people in that context, for example, that the wider community that has formed you didn't really form you. You utterly form yourself. All of the burden of being who and what you are is born on your own 2 shoulders, and you don't have a community to bear that burden for you. You're responsible for your own self-creation. And he thought that's not what human life is actually like. It requires a lot of cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
To say
you're resisting against the way the world is.
Yeah. Indeed. And but he thought as well as that individuality is a good thing. And he's a late modern person. So there's a challenge, which is how do you reconcile the one and the many in terms of individuals and the units that form them, which are families of one kind or another. So he thought that the reconciliation of those things, or the harmony between those things, this is an argument for why Christianity can do this. It can teach you how to be part of a bigger group or a family or something like that, and it can teach you what it means to be an individual. But if you don't have something to hold those 2 things together, then you end up with, the pendulum can swing between a radical communitarian way of being human where you've got no choice at all and you're just pressed into a mold. And he thought that's not true to life either, because humans are distinct. Every new individual human is a product, he said, of 2 distinct family histories, 2 distinct, the 2 halves of the genetic equation there that produce every new individual. And so it's not true to life just to press us all into a mold. But it's also not true to life just to completely shut your eyes as to all of the different things that, whether you like it or not, have shaped you and produced you. So you need something to bring about a harmony. And for him, this is an argument for Christianity and a challenge to other takes on things as to how they'll hold these 2 things together in a livable way.
Yeah. James, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today and introduce maybe many of us for the first time to this great thinker, this great theologian in the Christian tradition, Herman Bavinck.
Thank you for having me.
That was James Eglinton on the person and influence of Herman Bavinck. For more, be sure to check out the 2 books by Bavinck that he helped to translate and edit, Christianity and Science and Christian Worldview. Pick up a print copy of either book for 30% off, or get the ebooks for 50% off directly from Crossway by visiting crossway.org/plus. If you like this interview, check out my conversation with Andrew Balich entitled, What an Old Puritan Can Teach Us About the Holy Spirit. Follow the link in the show notes to hear him give an overview of who John Owen was and walk us through his work on the Holy Spirit. You can also find a link to more interviews we've done related to other notable figures and events in church history. For more audio content like this, subscribe to the Crossway Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. If you enjoyed this episode, consider sharing it with a friend and leaving us a review. Crossway is a not-for-profit Christian ministry that exists solely for the purpose of proclaiming the truth of God's Word through publishing gospel-centered content. Visit us today at crossway.org.